Hello, I'm Ajahn Subhuro, and I recently attended 2 weeks worth of retreats run by an organization called Insight Dialogue. And what they teach, and I find tremendously beneficial, even as a monk of 16-year seniority, is right speech and how to bring mindfulness to social interaction and how to make relationships more kind and calm and peaceful through practice. Before I ordained as a Buddhist monk, I attended 7 or 8 10-day-long meditation retreats run by the Vipassana Foundation, also called the Goenka Retreats. A lot of Westerners like myself who first approached Theravada become attracted, even converted to Buddhism, by attending these retreats. Most Westerners will have some sort of a wow experience while meditating on these retreats where you practice 10 or 11 hours a day for 10 days in a row. And virtually everybody comes out of those retreats highly inspired, highly optimistic, with a fresh view on life again. A new way of looking at the world, looking at their lives from the point of view of the Dhamma. But what often happens is once they return back, this happened to me too, once they return back to their normal lives, their jobs, their relationships, etc., all of a sudden all the magic is gone. All that wonderful peace seems to vanish in a finger snap, and it's rather frustrating. So then people will kind of slog it through, you know, meditating 1 or 2 hours a day as they can to keep their practice alive, to keep it from dying completely until they can go on the next retreat, maybe a year later. This is what I did for 7 or 8 years before I ordained as a Buddhist monk. I kept going on these 10-day retreats, and those retreats went a long way to helping me to cope, helping me to do my best in my, you know, in the jobs I had, in the relationships I had. My life would have been much more, you might say, frazzled, frayed without that practice. But could I keep that magic alive between the retreats? Sadly, no, I couldn't. And this is common and normal. Now, Insight Dialogue, they kind of break down what the practice of right speech would actually feel like were we to take pains to do it carefully, okay? All over the place in the suttas, the Buddha does say, well, yeah, you have to have right speech. Well, yeah, you have to have spiritual friends or kalyanamittas. Well, yeah, there's a whole bunch of unskillful behaviors you should not do, which will compromise your morality, will compromise your sila. Don't do those things. But there is surprisingly little said in the early Buddhist texts, which I've read through 5 times over now. There's surprisingly little said in the way of a method or a technique as to just how to practice right speech, just how it can be done, where we can keep our peace of heart alive, keep our mindfulness stable and steady. I think that the early Buddhist texts are not to blame here in that they said everything they could, which was of a generalized nature, which would apply to everybody across the board. It provided a solid framework to see what this practice was going to entail. But when we come down to it, when we come down to the day-to-day, moment-to-moment practice of it, it's been my experience, it ends up being a rather personal, rather customized, rather tailored sort of undertaking, given the person's individual personality traits. Myself, as an example, I'm more of an introverted person. I generally don't enjoy all that much being around others compared to being alone. I quite enjoy my time alone. I quite enjoy my seclusion. I've always found it a challenge to remain mindful and remain peaceful around others. And Insight Dialogue has helped me tremendously to keep that mindfulness much better and even start enjoying being around other people. This is a rather big deal in my life. You might think it's kind of trivial, but for me, no, it's kind of a big deal. So I want to share a little story about how I improved my mindfulness tremendously while being around other people. Okay, so they have these different little exercises you do on these retreats, these Insight Dialogue retreats. The in-person retreats are way better than the Zoom meetings which they offer for practicing, you know, in real life. And the Zoom meetings are okay, but in-person's way better. So you join into, they call it dyads, okay, groups of two. And you co-meditate together, meaning you're both meditating at the same time together. And they have a variety of little exercises you do to see if you can stay mindful during their, you know, undertaking. So the exercise at hand in this example was to go on about a 40-minute walk, a pleasant walk in nature. This is on the nice concrete pathways of the Lantau Hills. This is in Hong Kong. And now here's how I resolved to keep my mindfulness together. And now normally I might only be able to keep my mindfulness, 40% of the time, let's say. A good day would be 60, 70, 80% of the time throughout the day. But on this exercise, wow, I really did a job that I was quite proud of. I got it like 99% mindfulness this time. So here's what I did. Hopefully this helps you. I tried to keep my mindfulness centered on my chest, right here where I am touching. I would call this area the heart, okay? And that's not like the physical heart over here on the left side of the chest. The Buddha, it keeps talking about the citta in the suttas. And it's just sort of assumed you know what he's talking about. He doesn't really define it all that well. It's not explained all that well. It's not some sort of like scientific term, you know, like an organ that a doctor could tell you all about. It means sort of like the heart, but it also kind of means the mind too. It's this very multifaceted, flexible term. And you're just sort of assumed to understand what he's talking about. Anyway, if I were to point at where my citta was, I would say here. Okay, that's just my my take on it. So that was my top priority in this exercise, was to keep mindfulness on this area inside my chest, and not the surface of my chest where my fingers are touching. No, inside my torso, in the middle, halfway through to this, you know, to the back surface of my torso. Okay, and then as we walk together, me and my co-meditator, all the vision which my eyes were seeing was a secondary thing. And this is tricky to do. There's so many nice sights to see. There is beautiful flowers. Sometimes there's exotic birds. Or there's the sky. Or there was other hills. There's nice views, etc. It's tempting to look at those things and have them sort of occupy all of my attention. But no, I was going to keep my awareness on my chest as top priority. And then vision became this secondary thing. And I endeavored to make my vision as wide out to the sides as possible. Okay, so not a focused in vision, like I'm looking at specific objects, but rather like a panoramic kind of vision, but also seeing up high and also down low too. You know, almost like a big fisheye lens kind of a view. Taking in as much as possible and focusing in on no particular thing. And I would always pan my head around. Panning means to kind of turn it around a little bit like this, just like you pan a camera around. I would pan my head a little bit to always include the co-meditator, even in the peripheral vision. You know, way out to the side, the meditator would still be in my vision. And I felt, I found anyway, this was the best way to keep the context in mind that we're going for a walk together, okay? If I paid 0% attention to my co-meditator, well, that's too little attention. It's as though I'm walking alone or I'm ignoring them, and that's kind of rude. But if I just stared straight at them with 100% attention, well, that's too much attention. That's to ignore the context of, well, we are going on a walk and mindfulness is the top priority here. You know, this is supposed to be a form of meditation we're doing together. We are co-meditating after all. This isn't about socializing. This isn't about, just chit-chatting about whatever. Okay, so I'd always keep this co-meditator in my field of vision. And wherever the co-meditator went, whether up ahead or trailed back behind, you know, I would pan my head and I'd always include them. And then if I spoke, I'd look at the co-meditator, make eye contact. And if they spoke, again, I'd make eye contact. But like I said, I was keeping my awareness centered on my chest as top priority. So there's kind of a delicate balancing act to this all. It's challenging, I tell you. This might sound easy. Just try it. You'll see how challenging it is. This took years, by the way, years of practice to come around to being able to kind of balance this all, okay? And the benefit of doing this, you might wonder, well, why take all those pains? Bhante Subro, why would you... What's the outcome of it? What's the resultant of it? Well, by keeping my awareness in the center of my chest as top priority, then the way that I used my eyesight, okay, the way that I employed my sense door of vision became much more sort of like cooled off. Or you might say it became more like cooled down. I wasn't focusing on any specific thing. I was just seeing all of sight together at once, as though it were a great big painting. And since I was panning my head, I like to also include the sky, whenever the sky could be seen between the trees, and connect with a sense of spaciousness as well, like the infinite distance of the sky, or maybe I could see kind of a nice valley with trees, you know, between myself and the next kind of hilltop. And by keeping my sense of sight in this more secondary priority or cooled off sort of manner of attending, that stopped me from getting too almost graspy with how I used my sight, okay? The normal way that I would use my eyesight if I didn't employ this mindfulness, it is a more graspy kind of seeing where I'm discerning objects, okay? Here's a book, here's a smartphone, here's a cup of coffee or whatever it is, okay? Kind of like just kind of moving from object to object. Here's an attractive bird, here's a beautiful flower. And a lot of thinking comes along with that. A lot of imagining comes along with that, planning, memories come along with that. And it's easy to get lost in thoughts. That's sort of the beginning of becoming lost in thought and losing mindfulness, okay? So all this all these objects of meditation I just explained head off that graspy way of seeing, which then leads to being lost in thought. Okay, this heads it off. I like this word, to preempt it. That's kind of a geeky word. To preempt it, meaning like, do something early which is good to avoid something later which is what you would prefer to avoid. Okay, preempt it. Stop something bad from happening by doing something good in its place ahead of time. That is to preempt. Yeah, so this was such an enjoyable walk. Not only mindful, but enjoyable. Downright joyous, okay? I would just pan my head around a tiny bit. And, you know, I could see the path well enough in front of me. Thankfully, this path was a nice, well-maintained path. There was no tree roots. There were no stumps. There was no garbage. There was no danger. Okay, it was a very nice path where I didn't really have to look intently in front of me. Now, at the time of the Buddha, he does have a training for the monks that when they go walking, oh yes, they should keep their eyesight on the path in front of them, just one plow length in distance from in front of them, roughly, let's say, 6 or 8 feet ahead. Let's say 3 meters ahead, two or three meters ahead. And that makes sense in ancient India, where it's going to be a dirt road, probably. It's going to be uneven. There's probably going to be ruts. The various farm animals are going to be relieving themselves here and there. And you don't want to step in it with your bare feet. You very especially don't want to step in it with your bare feet that have cuts or cracks and are bleeding. But, you know, I had sandals and it's a nice path. I hardly had to look at it. So I had the luxury of just sort of, you know, panning my head around, seeing this big fisheye lens view of things and keeping my co-meditator always within at least my peripheral vision, having a sense of where they were with a sense of the space. Okay. And neither focusing too much on them nor too little. And it made for such a nice walk. Neither of us pulled out any smartphone. No smartphone made any noise the whole time. The conversation was very simple. It hardly mattered, in fact, what we talked about. Because the walk was so enjoyable. Just being in each other's company in this peaceful, simple way. The Dhamma itself provided all the context we needed, all the enjoyment we needed. Just seeing nature, just seeing the trees, the sky. It was such a nice day. Like, it was, we were happy to just be alive, just enjoying our practice. It was challenging, yes, but very rewarding at the same time. And I dare say I came away with it that, like, wow, this is, if I had my way, this is what social interaction would be like all the time. Where life is left simple when it doesn't need to be complicated. Only speaking when there's some reason to speak. And just remaining mindful. And harvesting joy, harvesting happiness from how we are meditating as the primary activity we're actually doing. So there was this balance which was held that I was so happy to have gained some skill in, which is that of I neither paid too much attention to the co-meditator nor too little. That walk was a walk together. But it wasn't like we were placing a lot of emphasis on like getting to know each other or whatever. impressing each other. Nobody had to try. Nobody had to prove anything. Neither of us had anything to prove. It was awesome. We were just comfortable going for that walk.